Senate Bill 5515 and House Bill 2052, both relating to housing and community services development. Our department, we're going to be having public hearing today, and we'd like to begin with Bob Repine and Jack Kinney. And
Mr. Chairman, committee member. I am Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services, and once again, happy to be with you. Jack Kinney is here also. He'll take a role in this presentation, and then Satish, obviously from BAM, will be here to fill in his comments as needed or requested. Mr. Chairman and committee member, I wanted to go back in time, obviously. It's been a while since we've been in front of you. There was a series of questions that had been raised through either comments directly or indirectly by the committee members. And I have some responses to those, Mr. Chairman. I don't know. They're not a great deal of the questions that I'm going to respond to. I think there's about seven. If you want me to just highlight those, or if, would you like me to refresh your memories what they were, anything in particular?
I'd like to first see if we have any written material on that. Was that presented?
It was our plan to address the questions orally in our testimony today.
Right. Okay, so I think it's a great place to start. Just give us the question and the answer.
All right, I'll try to make them as brief as possible, and if you have questions, you can go ahead and ask them. Mr. Chairman, committee members, the first question I had was a question raised about our relationship with Habitat for Humanity. It shows in our budgeting sheet one of those small, relatively small incidental accounts that we have. I think it's a $40,000 account. The question was raised by one of the members is this small amount of money of any importance that it could be blended or put together with another program. About 5 years ago, I made an effort to reach out to the Habitat Organizations of Oregon to try to give them some assistance, both in housing opportunities and some financial assistance and some mortgage assistance. We chose to set a small, very small portion of our pre-development money, which that $40,000 represents, aside for them, so they could come in and ask us to loan them up to $40,000 with no interest, so they could acquire land when land became available to them. If a owner or somebody came to them and said, I've got these three lots, if you want to sell them to me or to you, Habitat, I want you to get them, but I need to have the deal closed in a week, which is not uncommon. And so we wanted to have a resource available for Habitat so they could acquire the land and then through their fundraising process figure out a way to pay us back the money. So it's been very successful in those using it for that application.
How frequently has that been used?
Well, and also, we've got 29 loans with Habitat affiliates right now, and it's limited by the amount of 0% bond interest that we're able to generate.
Mr. Chairman, relative to the pre-development money, I can think of at least two incidences where the local Habitat facilities have used that money to secure or put a down payment on land, and then they eventually collateralized the loan with some other tool and then have paid our money back. But again, it's no money, no interest, and instant money for them, just as the security would be the land, so there really wasn't any other collateral they would have to put up just to try to support them. The 29 loans that Mr. Kinney mentioned to you was an effort we made to offer them under Habitat policies. They do not incur interest for the people who are residents in Habitats. It's against their principles to charge interest for the money. So we created a process by using some, during our better years, a couple of years ago, we were able to create some zero interest coupons relative to our bond sales. And we then took those zero interest coupons and made those available to the local Habitats so they could actually sell their mortgages to us at no interest to their residents and free up the equity that they had already made on that house, either through sweat equity contributions or direct gifts, and use it to build another house. So in that vein, one could arguably say that the 29 houses that we financed at zero interest for them freed up enough resources so they could go build another 29 without having, so they were able to leverage their already raised money.
So the 29 is not $40,000 or less quick. This is actual mortgages.
Those were mortgages. The $40,000 is just dealing with the pre-development money that's available for them if they need to come in and get resources quickly to acquire land.
Okay. Senator Johnson?
I think that's a great program. Have you bumped up against the ceiling on the 40? Is there more demand than your 40,000 can accommodate?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, we've had occasions where that is the case, but they are very mindful of it, and they try to orchestrate those requests in a way that doesn't have an over-demand on the money. Sometimes it'll come. It's not always the 40,000. They might just need 5,000 of it to fill a gap or make a down payment on a property to securitize it to the extent where they can get it refinanced somehow.
So it sounds like a really good partnership.
It's been a very, very helpful partnership with the Habitat. Again, Mr. Chairman, the reason we do that is they put people in home ownership at 30% median income. Our first-time homebuyer program generally addresses people at 60 to 80% median income on ownership, so they fill a whole marketplace that we can't even get near to.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
This is a little bit far-fetched, but I know that Habitat has regular fundraising opportunities. Is there a mechanism by which you could receive additional money into that account to make available for Habitat from eleemosynary sources rather than state sources?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, Senator Johnson, we've never pursued that. Generally, Habitats, even though they are a statewide organization, they have a statewide affiliation. They all run independently, and they are like any other boards that I've run into, that some are willing to maybe pool their money together. Some may not be as willing as others.
Just seems a good way to reuse the money, and if somebody were inclined to make a charitable donation, an estate or something, into your account. I just didn't know if you had the mechanism to receive it.
No, Senator Johnson. We would currently, they as nonprofits would have that ability to receive those as donations, contributions. Second issue or question that came up was dealing with the incentive fund program, community incentive fund monies. That was a program that was created a couple of sessions ago, then under the direction of Governor John Kitzhaber, that effectively made resources available through bond sales, lottery-backed bonds, to this agency to use those funds to create incentives for revitalizing downtowns and small communities with an emphasis on housing job balance and density issues in a healthy downtown environment. And with those funds over those years, which was about $20 million, if I'm not mistaken, $20 million, we have used those resources all around the state of Oregon. I can give you a list that didn't bring those, but they have been used everywhere from Astoria all the way down to Central Point, all the way over to, I'm trying to remember where else they might be. I know they're in all corners of the state. Baker City has it. Lakeview has it. It was really distributed in a very broad geographical distribution process. It was competitive. The people who were competing for it were either local nonprofits in communities or possibly public partnerships with nonprofits trying to take a little resources that came from this project to either improve or enhance their downtown vitalities. And they were loaned, those funds were made available both either as a loan and or a grant, and the advisory group that made those decisions that are defined in statute, the decisions and the group, chose to make the loan grant availability a 50-50. So in that context, of the $20 million that we have utilized, approximately $10 million of it was made for loans through communities, and $10 million was made for grants. Also, at the same time, the resources that were spent have leveraged literally hundreds of millions of other dollars in those communities where they may not have started or accomplished the tasks that we funded for them. I'll give you a couple examples, Mr. Chairman. In your case, the downtown parking structure in downtown Medford in the revitalization area of your urban development area, that parking lot structure was purchased using those incentive fund monies. Had it not been for that, they probably would not have been able to go ahead with that project. Next question dealt with Oregon affordable housing tax credits. The question was, how do they play into the affordability of housing in Oregon? The simplest way to describe Oregon tax credits, first of all, it's a very unique program within the nation. Most states, if any states, have a similar project, a program like this. With the Oregon Lenders Tax Credits, the credits are made available to Oregon lenders only, and those credits are bought on a value where, in turn, the credit then is passed on to the rental property at the end of the deal to reduce the interest rate so that at the same time the interest rate is being reduced, that rents can then correspondingly be reduced at the same time. So let me give you an example. If a housing project was coming in without tax credits, you might be hitting a, say, a market range of 60% median income somewhere in the state. And the loan was at 8% for the term of the mortgage. By selling credits to that development, Oregon Lenders Tax Credits, the rents then would be probably readjusted to accomplish housing for people at, say, 40 to 50% median income. So you get to a lower income Oregonian, and it, by doing that, you would lower the rent, would be the interest on the loan would go from 8% to 4%. The requirement of the Oregon Lenders Tax Credit, which makes it so unique, is that the pass-through savings has to be shown on the rent side. So there's no profit made by anybody. It's part of the lenders in the state of Oregon who want to participate in for their community. They have their federal requirements for community reinvestment, and this is a great way for them to reinvest in the communities, buy these tax credits, take and make sure that rents are being reduced for the term of the mortgage.
It's really the only way, Jack Kenny, Deputy Director. It's really the only way, as Section 8 is reduced and lost, it's really the only way that our department has to reach residents, Oregonians at 30 to 40% of area median income. Most of our other programs, it's very difficult to achieve those low rent levels. And as Bob said, every dollar in tax credit, we verify that is a dollar in rent savings to Oregonians.
So it's, again, very very practical, very important piece of our work that we do in the state of Oregon to maintain affordability.
Do you want me to talk about continuum care briefly?
Sure,
there was a brief question as to a little more information on continuum of care. Our department basically coordinates the rural continuum of care application. It's a federal competitive grant. It's used transitional housing, permanent supportive housing for disabled people, special needs populations. Primarily, I think residents have to, the tenants have to be homeless or at risk of homeless at the time that they apply for the housing. And it's primarily delivered through our community action agencies throughout rural Oregon.
Next question was asked about regarding our residential loan program, primarily issues around our default rate and how do we compare to the national standards on default of single-family loans. Our housing council, actually last week, was given this same had asked the same information, so we made a report available to them. And just to highlight that report, in the history of the first-time homebuyer program, we've had over 21,000 loans that have been on the books at one time or another. Currently, we have around a little over 7,000 single-family loans on our books. In our last year's rate of default was, if I remember correctly,
2.54, I believe.
Thank you, 2.54%.
Which is a percentage below the national average, at least.
And as far as losses go, that if you were to look at that in a loss ratio, it cost the agency, if I remember the number correctly, I apologize, I think there was a total of 25 or 28 loans that went into foreclosure, and it average cost to the agency was about $1,500 per closure. So that's our exposure was around $40,000 to $44,000, as a, compared to, you know, it's because they're all reinsured or insured by FHA. So we would say that's a pretty well-performing portfolio. And this actually will change, Mr. Chairman and committee member. With the new rates as low as they've been, we've been getting having a lot of pre-sales or loans being taken out and being refinanced through other lending firms. Some of our higher interest rate loans are older ones. So as those 9% are going away, as our new loans are coming in at the lower rate, right now we're at 4.95% interest, 30-year fixed mortgage. The more loans we get into our book at this rate today will guarantee the surety of that portfolio over time, because we don't think, that rates would ever get much below 4.95 to an extent where people would want to be refinancing. Next question. It's a community development block grant program that we run through our agency, and what does that program support? This is a program that came to our agency last session. It used to be run by the Department of Economic and Community Development. It was a small amount of CDBG funds, community development block grant funds, that were made available through a program they called Residential Rehabilitation. It was a effort by the Economic Community Development to try to create opportunities in parts of the state, all parts of the state, where there could be resources available for residents to use this source of money through their local communities and partners for remodeling or repairing their residential homes. We took the program over, as I mentioned, from last session, and we restructured the program where we now run the community development block grant program through a series of programs, what we call housing resource centers. Housing resource centers have been established through our agency to be a one-stop shop for citizens in the state of Oregon to find all the answers and all the needs they need for housing issues, everything for weatherization needs, for energy assistance needs, for home ownership needs, or home ownership repair. And so this money is actually sent out to our housing resource centers where they in the community have people who will make application for those resources. And what makes the program more dynamic than it ever has been is that we've taken this, this amount of federal dollars, which is the CBDG dollars, and put those alongside of our other weatherization programs and our other assistance programs. So when somebody comes in now to one of these facilities, before, if they were just looking for, I have a leaky roof, can you help me? They can now find out if their roof is leaking, that's a problem, but then you find out maybe their furnace isn't working, or they have broken windows, or they have no insulation in their house. So they will be able to have that community partner, that housing resource center, do an analysis of their entire house and saying to that party, we have money that will fix your roof, but we also have some money that would improve your weatherization so your electric bill will be reduced. Or we can repair that broken furnace for you so you don't have to keep burning firewood. So it really becomes a very inclusive process, so the people, when they leave there, they would have a dwelling that would be both better off than it was before. And actually what we see it is it saves and keeps a valuable piece of housing inventory in a repair level that would be important to make sure that that house is there for future generations to buy.
Right. A lot of times this is what
question
keeps
on it. Oh, and that okay. is, after the money is expended, is this purely a grant, or is this a low-interest loan that goes on the...
Mr. Chairman and committee members, when we took this over, originally it was pretty much a grant program. We decided to our housing resource centers to let them know that, and we worked with HUD to get an official approval on this, where actually... Once the money has been used in a loan capacity, be it a zero-interest loan or whatever it might be, they then put it on to the property. When the property money does recycle, then they can use it again. So it actually stays within the neighborhood and it starts building some equity over time for these community partners.
This is a huge improvement to the program that Bob Gillespie and our staff and HUD were able to accomplish, so that the funds continually recycle. But again, there's no hardship on the elderly owner or whoever it would be, because the loan doesn't come due until the house changes hands.
You know, if there's anything, this is a little bit aside, but just from your experience of how everything functions, is there any provision in Oregon law that would allow a family to borrow money in a similar kind of circumstance to help a student get through college?
Against their house mortgage?
Yeah, perpetual education fund, where... You know, the seed money's there. It helps the education go through. Then it gets paid back. I mean, it serves as a loan, and hopefully the student will pay it back as well. But right. but that way there's some security long-term for the state, but that the state makes money available in, you know, a way that they wouldn't have otherwise.
Mr. Chairman, not to my knowledge, that I know that there's a process in place that involves collateralizing your house for a student loan under that same pretense. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions on the community development block grant? All right. Food programs in general, or just a general discussion of about our programs. Obviously, we've had a long-standing relationship with the Oregon Food Bank. In our budget, as you know and you will see, there is a line item, general fund, that goes to the Oregon Food Bank, which is the state's primarily only general contribution they make for the food activities within the state of Oregon. We are but a small piece of the resources that comes to the Oregon Food Banks, either directly to the bank or to their field facilities, pantries, or other food banks around the state of Oregon. We have that because of the fact that the hunger piece or the food component came over to the agency back in 1991 when it was part of the community services component of the Department of Human Services. It felt that the activities along food and weatherization in this application were more appropriate to line up with our housing activities, and so it was moved over back in 1991, and we still believe that there is a very strong correlation between affordable housing, issues around hunger, and issues around homelessness that really feed upon each other and need to work in a very, very decisive manner to make sure that if you're addressing one, you're not forgetting about the other.
And in response to the chair's question from the earlier session, talking about food pantries, local food pantries, many times faith-based food pantries, typically the food that is originated through our department and through the food bank or through federal programs is delivered to local community action agencies who work with local service providers such as faith-based pantries and other non-faith-based service delivery. So in some cases, the community action agencies have their own food delivery mechanism, and in other cases, they work through subrecipients in local communities.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berger.
I have a question, and I'm just going to interject it right here in the middle of this because it comes to my mind sometimes after I've seen you in my office and I fail to ask you about it. I want to know, when you're dealing with housing and with the food bank or whatever, is there any assistance to people to help them learn how to live life a little better in management skills? Because we never, you never get anywhere if people don't learn how to change their lifestyle a little and be able to manage what you've helped provide them. So I wish you'd touch on that for me.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'll try to do it without mining down to details. Oregon Food Bank, as a program, and generally in many of the communities, I can't say all, offer cooking classes, as an example, to teach people how to make the best of a meal of the products. So they're not just buying frozen good products, but you're buying things that are more stable, fresh items, and showing people basically how to cook where maybe their parents had never showed them how to really prepare a meal. So there is an ongoing education through Oregon Food Banks and many of their subsidiaries that will help along with that.
Chair Richardson, Representative Berger, there's a few other programs just to touch on just quickly. Rick reminded me that Tenant Readiness Training is a program that's delivered, and you saw that in one of the small programs that got some attention. Why are there so many small programs? This is one that Bob championed statewide. Bob used to say, I can't build my way out of this housing crisis we have in Oregon. We really need to train people to be better renters. And a lot of times people wouldn't be allowed to rent a home because of a bad credit history, sometimes through no fault of their own, sometimes through some bad lifestyle choices. So that's something that, again, is delivered typically through housing centers or community action agencies. It's not a big dollar number in the budget because it's successful. We basically back up people who go through a training on how to be a better renter and how to budget. So that's another example. And then I guess to answer the question more globally, you'll see one of the positions in the packages that's going to be talked about later in this hearing is a services coordinator program. And I know the private sector landlord groups had been working with us for years to say, if you're going to give a low-income housing and give subsidized rents, or you're going to invest grant money into these, that's in some cases similar to what's in the private sector, what's going to distinguish it? And the tax credit law, for example, requires a service component. So our service coordinator that you will hear about a little bit later has done a comprehensive at least inventory of what services are being provided relevant to the population. If it's someone who has a drug and alcohol abuse, it might be different than somebody who's, you know, English is a second language, or, as you said, life skills, if they're, you know, coming out of a broken home and need those things. So it's something that we are beginning to address more comprehensively, at least through the supportive services and housing. So I think hopefully 2 years from now, at least even today, we at least have an inventory of what services are provided, by whom, and to what extent. And so I don't know if it's not a great answer to your question, but I think we're getting there.
It is. A follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Yes, you say it's not a big budget number. It's not. But I think one of the failures of the HUD program, as far as public relations were concerned, for the people to watch these big units go up, and then they moved in people by the hundreds down in California, and did not teach them anything about how to live in this country. And so they did things that came very normal to them that absolutely destroyed the property. So I think that is that's a significant. The other thing that I'd want to say is that I'd be happy for you to work yourself out of a job. In other words, just so that we'd get people all provided for and everybody could be independent and have their own home. You'll never do it, but it is a nice goal.
I want to do that before I retire.
Well, at least give people the tools for those who want to work their way out of poverty to have the best opportunity to do so.
That's right.
So, again, Jack has highlighted the Ready to Rent program, which we think is was a very comprehensive program where we put a guarantee behind the success of this renter to a landlord, a private landlord. So we say to this landlord, if you take the chance or the commitment to rent to this person who's gone through this training and has proved to us and the trainer that they have competency in being a good steward of your land or your property, we will set a kind of a blanket guarantee behind them that if anything happens in the first 6 months of their rental, we will financially cover that up to $1,000. And we have had a huge amount of success from the private sector, because one of the things that have kept private sector people from wanting to do this, even though they personally would like to do it, they can't afford the exposure of the cost, of the risk, of the damages that might come their way. And so to give you a level of success, this has been doing for years now, and Portland's probably the best example because it's the largest population where we have that. They had, I want to remember the number, I might be wrong, Mr. Chairman, if I state this, and I can get the right number for you, but I think last year they had like 285 placements using a ready-to-rent program. Now realize these are 285 people who are not generally rentable. They have bad credit, they have criminal problems, they have bad income to rent debt, I mean a variety of things that haunt them. 285 people who were given these vouchers that we back up, and they only lost on six of them. So we had $6,000 worth of good we had to put out. So if you think about 285 people who generally would have not been in market rate housing, got into market rate housing because we were willing to say, well, we'll put some money behind them to show you that they can be good renters. And we only lost six of them. Now, that's a pretty good investment. And the landlords like it because it creates a supply for them they generally steer away from for the fear of the consequences of those renters. Okay. Just generally, there was a question on small programs. Jack talked about a little bit. We do have, as you saw on our sheet of programs and priorities, we have lots of programs. And I guess the only way I can defend the lots of programs that we have is there is... in our world that we work in housing, it's much like you as people who represent different parts of the state. Some of you rent represent large populated areas. Some of you rent small, low populated areas. Each one of those areas have distinct characteristics and needs that one size doesn't fit all. And so we've tried to customize programs to make it very user-friendly. So if you're in the big city, we have programs that are more designed to work in the big city. If you happen to be in a small rural community, we have a process that allows you to work more comfortably and more fashionable in a small environment with those resources. So it's opposed to saying we have one program, you all got to fit into that one program. We've tried to create, without making too much difficult work for ourselves, a lot of different ways to customize our product and process so it's more accessible to our partners and fits their needs without having them go through undue strain and aggravation.
And I would say to the extent that we can through processes like the consolidated funding cycle, it's not as though we have 65 different application processes and things like that. So a lot of the programs, as Bob said, maybe farm worker programs as an example. They might have used to been with another agency, and they decided to consolidate the farm worker programs, farm worker housing programs within our department. So they have different statutory references. They have different sources. But we do consolidate them for the in the best interests of the people who administer and deliver the services as best we can.
Are you coordinated with DHS and the services that they provide so that a client would not need to fill out multiple redundant applications?
Chairman, I guess the question, I don't know what redundant applications they might be, but we work very closely with the Department of Human Services on with their people who do their housing programs, to make sure that we are not either duplicating and we're meeting addressing the needs that they seem to be more prevalent looking at the time, so there isn't us wandering off one way doing something with housing when they're looking for housing to meet some other need in the communities. So we work very close in that regard. We actually have some of their funds that they actually get for, as example, alcohol and drug treatment. They actually give us that money to put into our consolidated funding cycle, so it matches up and gets leveraged to the highest degree it can, matching the population and the needs of those populations with our programs.
When you use the word match, you're talking about, is there federal money involved? Yes. So you get federal match through?
They get alcohol and drug money from the federal government for housing, and okay. They've chosen to take a piece of it and use it with us to make sure they maximize the investment. I'm going to move along. Sorry, you had a question about Energy Trust and our role with the Department of the Energy Trust Group. That was a group that was formed last session because of Senate Bill 1149. We have ongoing working activities with the Energy Trust at all levels of programs and uses of our resources and the uses of their resources to make sure that they're is a no duplication or a minimum duplication of those expenses on our resources, along with the Department of Energy, who will all have a piece of those resources. So we want to make sure that the money is being used in the most efficient way we can for the state of Oregon.
We serve different populations, though, to a large extent.
Then I want to, just the final one I was going to talk about, and then Jack can finish up with accountability. Senior disabled was a question, why is it not a priority? If you look at our priorities, we have listed number 15, and there was a question, why was it at 15 versus out of the 53? First, to let you know that I don't actually, historically, seniors and people with disabilities have been always a high priority and an ongoing priority for this agency. We've probably done the very best, actually, in the last 20 years on housing people that are seniors oriented or with disabilities. The changes in the environment right now come about where it doesn't appearing that we do as much because, quite frankly, some of the financial tools we've had in the past that were able to be used through federal tax credits, 4% tax credits, really can't stand alone anymore as just the funding tool to make this happen like they used to do 20 years ago. It requires many, or if not most, of all the other funding tools we have. And so instead of them having an easy way to get funding through just a direct application process to get credits from us, they have to come through our consolidated funding cycle to get other subsidies to make the rents work at the end of the day. We still, in our consolidated funding cycle that we have many, many, many units that are put out for people with disabilities and special needs populations, and seniors fall into that category, special needs populations.
Okay. Try and touch quickly on accountability. It's a big stakes game when you're issuing tax exempt bonds under the Internal Revenue Code. So there's some things that are pretty much non-negotiable. They have and we're serving a target population that there's a high need. So obviously we get out annually or every 3 years, depending on the program, to make sure that the appropriate income levels are being served. Senator Verger talked about the Cabrini-Green type HUD projects. I can tell you some of the accountability issues, and I've worked with Bob directly on issues where there were projects or properties that were not being maintained to community standards. And we had to play pretty hardball with those people, you know, actually to the point of going to court to make sure that they maintain the projects to community standards, so it would be safe housing. So there are a lot of things, as I said, that are non-negotiable, that we want to make sure that housing has a good name in Oregon, that affordable housing, workforce housing, housing developed through state funds does meet community standards. And so we do have to spend a fair amount of money in monitoring, and it is very valuable. There's other areas that are, I guess, less negotiable, I mean, that are less non-negotiable, and that would be things like standards. And I don't know, we try to strike a balance, for example, on green building or sustainable development. Probably City of Portland has more stringent standards than our department does. There's always kind of a pushback, give and take on that. But you know, on services, it's another thing. If we don't require services, we get questions like Senator Verger that are valid, or we get landlords in the private sector saying, really, what's your service requirement? I think as we're moving down that road, we're trying to work with our partners to see what's out there, what's realistic to do that. But I'm sure you could talk to people and say, you know, visibility is another one. Legislation was enacted last session to say you need to do more to serve people who have who are handicapped or have special access needs. It puts a burden on the housing, but that's the law now. So again, we go through the public testimony and our administrative rules. So I think we try to strike a good balance with our partners relative to needs, because there's always two sides to every question on accountability. Again, the ones that are really the ones that we can't back off on are the Internal Revenue Code, and as well as like SEC requirements for our bond programs, things like that.
Mr. Chairman, then just a final comment on Jack's statement is we make all the efforts available to our partners. When we have these discussions, excuse me, I still have a cold, so I'm a little hoarse. When we have these type of discussions on standards or requirements of performance or services, or you know, we involve our partners, we invite them to the table and sit them down with us saying, okay, here's what we are charged to do. How can we best accomplish this so it becomes both beneficial for you and beneficial for us? And so we create these working groups on an ongoing basis so we can have these discussions. So we do not make these accountability issues in a vacuum by us saying, well, by gosh, I think everybody should be hitting this standard, and that's the way it's going to be. We have an open discussion. Now, sometimes that open discussion may want to go past the thing, let's just ignore the regulatory responsibilities, and we can't do that. But where we can make those adjustments so it becomes more user-friendly for the accountability piece, we really strive to make that become a reality for our partners. Because we know they do the housing, we just finance that.
Okay. Thank you. Before we go into Satish's portion or into Rick's, I would like to invite some of the public that have come so far.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Morris, thank you.
Before we
go,
dismiss our guests, just a quick question. As a follow-up to our discussion in my office with respect to prevailing wage applications, I know this is a very thorny issue, but it's one that seems to be having a rippling effect throughout the affordable housing, you know, stakeholders and communities. And I was just informed this morning that a project in my district had been, due to the uncertainty and the potential threat of applying prevailing wage provisions, that the project has been withdrawn. And if you might care to make some comments about the impacts upon the programs that you administrate with respect to broadening that application.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morris, the issue around bowling a prevailing wage is an issue we've been working on since about the first of the year, or just prior to the first of the year, with Commissioner Gardner. There was a administrative rule writing that came out that fundamentally was going to change much of the prevailing wage processes as we've known them in the past with our projects. And the issues evolve around two components. One is the public purpose, you know, does a funded project by the state of Oregon constitute it being a public purpose project? That's one. The second question is relative to the scope of control and requirements that we might have on the project. Those are the two areas where we've had some difference of discussion or difference of opinions. So to that those questions, we have put a request into the Department of Justice for an attorney's opinion, which we have just received that. We've not freed that report up because it's still under confidentiality until we finalize some technical adjustments in it. So we chose to go that route to be able to get some bright lines relative to our funding programs. I shared that opportunity with Mr. Gardner, and he accepted to be part of that discussion with us, and so his agency will be receiving the same information we are. We hope that with that delineation of that report that we will then have an opportunity to sit down and say, okay, this is what they say, now where are we going to be on this? As it stands right now, many of our projects, based on what we believe are the interpretations of that administrative rule, would suggest that we would be having to submit many of those projects to reconsider their costs for prevailing wage, which, in our opinion, would cause as much as 15% to 20% more in cost of the projects, which means we would do less projects. And in the state of Oregon, based on the need of affordable housing, less is not a good thing. So we are still working through those details. I feel comfortable and confident that there will be a resolve. I think the Attorney General's opinion letter will be is the most appropriate way to address these issues, so we can have a clear understanding from a third party that looks at this. That's where it stands at this point in time.
When are you going to be comfortable releasing that opinion?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morse, we've responded this week back to the Attorney General, the Assistant to the Attorney General, who's heading this letter writing up. And I suspect
could be as early as today, but probably by the end of the week.
End of the week, first of next week, we'll have the final version ready to go.
And I would request a copy, if I may, please.
Okay.
Mr.
And
Chair,
I suspect there are other members.
If it could come to the professional staff and we all get a copy of it, that would be great.
Okay.
I appreciate it. Good. Anything further?
No, thank you.
Okay, thank you, and we'll talk with you in a few minutes. We'd like to invite Margaret Davidson and Rocky Johnson to come forth. We're going to now kind of slip into public testimony because I know some of you have come a long ways. We have a lot of ground that we still have to cover, and so we would ask that each who come up would limit their remarks to between 2 and 4 minutes, give us a feeling what you need to say, and if there needs to be more than that, if you could provide it to us in written form later, it would be appreciated. Senator Johnson.
As the witnesses are getting settled, I just want to acknowledge the substantial contributions that Dr. Johnson makes in my legislative district. He is the go-to guy with respect to affordable housing and many other very valuable programs.
Well, good. We welcome you both here.
Okay. Thank you for hearing us.
On deck, we're going to have Cindy Cook and Jerry Croft.
Okay. My name is Margaret Davidson. I'm from LeGrand, representing Baker Grant Union in Wallowa Counties. I'm the Executive Director of Community Connection of Northeast Oregon, Inc., and a partner with Housing and Community Services Department, and here today to explain some of those programs that Mr. Repine and Mr. Kinney were just telling you about. Who would your neighbor turn to if he lost his job through no fault of his own, say through a corporate downsizing or change in the local economy? What if your single parent mother of three niece was fired when she missed work to stay home with her daughter who was just diagnosed with kidney disease? After exhausting all their family resources, they'd turn to their local community action agency. Community action agencies across the country have been working with local government, private enterprise, and citizen representatives to improve the living conditions of low-income persons for the past 40 years. A national network of 1,100 locally controlled, community-based, public and private nonprofit organizations blanket the country. Oregon has 18 of these community action agencies, covering every county in the state, the last two counties just being capped, as we call them this year, Malheur and Harney. Achieving a long-standing goal of community action and Housing and Community Services Department. Oregon's 18 community action agencies are represented by the Community Action Directors of Oregon, or CATO, who Rocky and I represent today. CATO's mission is promoting solutions to poverty. knowing we can't do this alone, we do it in partnership with other statewide and local planning efforts. Community action agencies are unique. In Oregon and across the U.S., no two are alike. Each is molded by the leadership and specific needs of its local community. But within this local control, there is a typical community action approach to fighting the causes and conditions of poverty. Cato and community action all across the country strive to change conditions that perpetuate poverty, especially inadequate housing, poor nutrition, lack of fundamental life skills and personal management abilities like Senator Verger was asking about, barriers to educational opportunities, and unemployment and underemployment.
Do you mind explaining how you go about dealing with life skill challenges?
When clients come to us either needing help with their housing situation, whether they need a week's lodging or maybe 6 to 12 months partial rent payment, we put them into a case management module where our trained case managers sit down with that family, help identify their barriers to self-sufficiency, whether it be life skills like money management, parenting issues, training needs, and then through that case management, we'll help them identify solutions to overcoming those barriers. We can't do this alone as a community action agency. It involves working with the workforce agency in the communities, the food banks, the schools. Many times it's, you know, educating those parents on what it means to be a responsible citizen these days. Many people aren't getting that at home anymore, and so it's having to be picked up by agencies like ours. Did that answer your question?
Oh, it did.
Okay.
How about leveraging local resources as far as money is?
In my own agency, we, with our core federal funding, which is the Community Services Block Grant, we leverage, I calculated it recently, I think it's $11 local and state money for every federal dollar that comes in, and then another $2.5, $3 in volunteer contributions. And I know, you know, that's probably
about
an
statewide average.
Average.
I think it's about 1 to 12 on a statewide average basis.
Okay, you said state and local to federal money.
Right.
How about local money to state money?
Local to state. Actually, my own agency's budget is federal, so I'd say that percentage would even increase when you look at the amount of local contributions contributed compared to the state.
Okay, generally, I think there are more state dollars than local.
You said that a large amount of your money is federal, then that means you must have a huge amount of state and local. Unless I didn't understand.
No, maybe I misspoke. A larger amount of federal money than state money. It passes through Housing and Community Services Department, but it originates at the federal level.
What I'm really asking, I guess, is what the amount of participation you have from local resources as far as contributions.
Tremendous. Right off the top of my head, thousands and thousands of volunteer hours, well over 100,000, valued at 100,000 or more in my own region. I wish I had the number with me, but it's significant.
Mr. Chair, we also work with a number of churches at the local level. We work with over 25 churches in my area, and they're involved from the standpoint of providing volunteer time as well as contributions.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
So it's a very valuable grassroots, locally based kind of resource that really makes our programs effective.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Just I'll wrap up quickly here. Each community action agency designs programs, like I said, based on its citizens and community needs. We talked about the local leveraging. Mobilizing the residents is key, like we were just getting to. And really, our ultimate goal is to support families and individuals seeking to become self-sufficient. And if you have my testimony, you can see I've outlined some of the programs there that the department was just talking about. Really key for people to understand is that the majority of community action clients are working at the time they seek help from us, or we're recently working. We're recently in the workforce. This is kind of contrary to the perception that many people have about who's seeking these state and locally supported services. And then if I could just wrap up to tell you about kind of a key Community Action Success Story back home. And this really demonstrates the wonderful thing about community action. Okay. In La Grande, we identified that 70% of our elementary age students were home alone after school. And my agency, through partnership with school districts, United Way, Housing and Community Services Support, churches, senior volunteers, et cetera, developed a before and after school program. And it's been very successful, growing to serve over 250 children this year. But without partnership with agencies like HCS, it wouldn't have been possible.
That's excellent.
Thank you
for all the good work you're doing.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rocky Johnson. I'm the executive director of Community Action Team. We are based in St. Helens and provide services to Clatsop, Columbia, and Tillamook counties. I want to focus my remarks today on the state homeless assistance program, otherwise referred to as SHAP. SHAP is a critical safety net providing shelter to homeless persons and families throughout the state of Oregon. On any given night in the state, about 7,000 people seek shelter because they're in crisis. And the response to this is to use the SHAP program and combine it with other resources to provide a statewide network of shelter services that provides assistance to over 6,000 people on any given night. For example, we use SHAP funds to support the operations of four shelters in Clatsop, Columbia, and Tillamook counties in our area. And all of these shelters struggle to stay open, and so any cut in the SHAP program would jeopardize their ability to maintain services.
Really quick, I have to interrupt.
Oh, excuse me.
And use a prerogative of the chair.
Okay.
We have some very, very special guests with us today, and I need them to introduce themselves first. But don't tell anyone where you're from yet.
Okay.
Okay. What's your name?
Rachel.
Olivia.
Mark.
Sarah.
Lucia.
And. And they have a pie. What type of pie is it?
An apple.
Apple pie for a very, very special senator here today. And would you go over and give the pie to the special senator that you want to give it to? She's this one right here. Senator Johnson. Senator Johnson, raise your hand. These are your constituents.
Well, welcome, guys. Thank you very much.
Very welcome.
Thank you. And thank you. Where are you from? Great. Terrific. All right, buddy. Go back down there and watch how the committee goes. Thank you, Governor.
Now, see, they came to visit the Capitol, and I said, you know, you can't just come to the Capitol to visit. You have to get a real hands-on experience. And so we just wanted to bring them to introduce you to you.
And any committee you get a pie in is a good committee.
Thank you very much.
I think it's time to break for pie now, right?
Yeah. That's what Repine's been saying all along.
Pie. More pie. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
I hope you enjoy your day in the Capitol.
Oh, we will.
That's kind of a tough one to follow, but I'll try and finish up.
Well, I saw those little blonde-haired kids running. I thought they were mine.
No, it was well worth it.
Went Thank chasing you. Them. So. Sorry for the interruption.
Thank you. Interrupt any time with pie.
Okay. Let me just wrap it up. There's a couple things I want to point out. One is that in terms of the number of persons served on a given night, I think it's important to note that 37% are children, and 17% or over 1,000 are children under 5 years of age. So I think that's an important piece of information for you to have. And in terms of the basis of the program, I think it's important to note that it's based on three core values. The first one is compassion for those in need. The second one is self-reliance, in that a lot of the people that we serve are able to maintain or get a job and then thereby make contributions back to their respective communities. And I think that issue was brought up before today in terms of discussion on the budgets. So that's a very important feature of the program, and we've attached some case examples of people that we have worked with that have gone on to be self-sufficient. So I think that's an important value that the program is based on. And finally, it's based on local community-based services. All of the SHAP dollars are contracted to nonprofit groups at the local level, and we think that's a very, very valuable feature of the program. So mainly, we want to thank you today for your effort to restore the cuts of the SHAP program that were contained in the governor's proposed budget. We thank you for your leadership on this issue, and we would also ask that you would consider favorably efforts to increase the amount of resources for affordable housing throughout the state, because that adds jobs and it also helps reduce the need for homeless services throughout Oregon. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Verger.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a question, but I want to just make a statement about homeless shelters. The community action in the southern part of my district, the Coos Bay North Bend area, is wonderful. I don't know what in the world we would have done without them. But he named compassion and self-reliance and local services, and I think all those are so important. But these people have a hill to climb. It was my nemesis in my 8 years as mayor. I had 250 to 300 people at a time clamoring for me to throw these people out in the street, rezone the area. They were not wanted. It's the NIMBY thing. And we wrote it out. And they're still there, and things are much better. But I say to my committee and my colleagues that it's all three of these things plus a tremendous effort to make people have that compassion for people that in some cases there, but for the sake of there go I.
Amen.
And so I just commend you for the work that you do. And if it had not been for people like you supporting me the 8 years that I had the good roller coaster ride with homeless shelter, it would have been a different story.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator.
Well, I would share with the committee that you have an excellent community action agency, but the second best, because Margaret Davison, hands down, represents the finest of northeastern Oregon. And I apologize for not recognizing you. I came in like a whirlwind, but when you got those kids, it's hard not to.
Yeah.
So,
for sure. Yeah.
Anyway, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. We're now going to call up, let's see here, Cindy Cook and Jerry Croft. Well,
thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Croft. I'm the executive director of the Salem Housing Authority, and it's also my privilege this year to serve as the president of the Association of Oregon Housing Authorities. Cindy Cook is with me as the executive director of the Central Oregon Regional Housing Authority. What I'm going to speak to you about is the nature of housing authorities, just briefly, and the lay of the land in terms of federal programs. Cindy's going to talk more about the importance of the OHCS budget and programs that that agency represents. First of all, the Oregon Association of Oregon Housing Authorities is 22 housing authorities that cover the entire range of the state of Oregon. We have a motto, and that is success has a home. To us, it is essential for families with children, seniors, persons with disabilities, to have stable housing if they're going to succeed in any form in a stable lifestyle. Housing authorities add to the local communities by partnering with many nonprofits, faith-based organizations, corporations, to provide not only affordable housing but related services that help families move up and out of need for assistance. Every year, housing authorities are the conduit for millions of dollars of federal Section 8 housing choice voucher monies. My own community here in Salem, we serve Salem and Kaiser, we're the conduit for about $13 million, over $1 million a month, flowing from the federal budget out to local landlords to help households survive in this community. Things changed quite a bit last year for the Housing Choice Voucher Program. The program changed from a tenant-based program where a certain number of tenants were supported down to a block grant where only a fixed amount of dollars were provided for each community. Each housing authority in the nation really had about a 7% cut in the amount of funding that we have to provide for our households. In my own agency, I'm going to serve about 194 fewer households this year than I did the year prior. The shortfall, looking statewide, in housing assistance payments is about $11 million just in the state of Oregon. So it's enormous in terms of how many fewer households we're going to serve. We had a loss of about 905 housing vouchers, all considered throughout the state. We have a waiting list of about 42,000 households within the state of Oregon. My own agency has a waiting list of about 6,000 households. Those households will wait for about 3 years for a voucher. We'd stop issuing vouchers the first of the year because we had this reduction in funding. We're going to hopefully start issuing vouchers again, but when somebody comes on that program, they'll wait at least 3 years, possibly 4 years, for that assistance. Talk just a little bit about the other major public housing, which is the other major federal program. There are two sources of revenue in the public housing program. Those are tenant rents and a subsidy that is provided to housing authorities by HUD. What's happened with the public housing program is that HUD has not been fully funding that subsidy for housing authorities. In 2006, HUD will provide 89% of the entitlement of subsidy funding to housing authorities. In my own agency, that means a reduction from about $1 million of subsidy down to a little under $900,000. So it's a considerable hit. And the rents, there aren't rents that can make up for that because people pay rents according to their income. So I don't have enough money to really operate that program without dipping into reserves. And that's the case with many housing authorities across this state and across the nation. I wanted to speak just briefly. Senator Verger made the comment about life skills. One of the main constituents of the public housing and the voucher program that we operate is something called family self-sufficiency. In the voucher program, for instance, as a family increases their income and it starts to move up and out of housing, they will have a reduction in the amount of subsidy that they receive. What HUD has allowed housing authorities to do, in my case with my agency, I have 151 family self-sufficiency slots, some in public housing, some in the voucher program. As there is a reduction in subsidy, HUD allows me to take that difference and put it into an account called an escrow that will eventually benefit that household when they move up and out of housing. Households usually take about 5 years to go through their family self-sufficiency program, and the barriers that they face range all the way from very basic life skills. How do I shop? How do I speak the language? I have substance abuse in the family, transportation issues, credit, job skills, education, health matters. We can take a family from disaster to the ability to get up and out of not only housing assistance but other forms of assistance within about 5 years. I've had right at 100 families go through self-sufficiency. I've only had one family need to come back, and that was a domestic violence case. And so very gradually we're able to transition families up and out of these kinds of programs. With that, I think I'll turn it over to Cindy to talk about the importance of the OHCS budget.
Mr. Chair, could I ask one question?
You bet.
Have you figured out what it costs you over a period of 5 years to get a family to a self-sufficiency level?
Well, no, we haven't. We really haven't looked at that specifically.
I know they'll all be different.
They will. We do receive some funding to help pay for staffing to do some of that case management. So much of that is done outside of our agency, though, with our partners. Chemeketa Community College here in Salem, for instance, is a very valuable partner in teaching life skills, and in many cases they do not charge us any direct dollars for that. They'll just partner with us to do it for free.
Okay, quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. The reason I'm so interested in that aspect is that children that grow up in a home that is well managed tend to follow those same patterns.
Yes, ma'am.
Of the parents.
I agree entirely.
Just one point of interest. We calculated the amount of housing assistance payments that were redirected to other families in need from those who graduated off of our FSS program. And in a five-year period, it was well over $4 million of direct housing assistance that went to other needy families. as these families moved off the program.
Cindy, could you introduce yourself for the record?
I'm sorry. I just had to add that. I'm Cindy Cook, and I'm the Executive Director for the Central Oregon Regional Housing Authority, Mr. Westland's district, and we serve Deschutes, Jefferson, and Crook County, and I'm really here to talk about a huge partnership that housing authorities in Oregon have with Oregon Housing and Community Services. Oftentimes, I think housing authorities have get this label that we are conduits or franchises of HUD, and I'm here to tell you that's not the case, and particularly in Oregon, there is a mentality within our housing authorities that we are community-based, that we're here to assist in getting housing choices and alternatives on the ground so that lower-income Oregonians have an opportunity for a hand up. And having said that, our organization over the past 15 years chose not to beat up on HUD for dwindling resources. We instead looked within our own bonding authority and looked at other resources that we could leverage to build affordable housing. And I'm proud to say today that we have over seven LLCs, seven limited liability partnerships, and we have housing all the way from seniors to special needs populations, particularly in the mental health arena, and farm worker housing, and workforce housing. So it's a very exciting time for us 15 years later to be able to look back and say, wow, out of the resources from the state of Oregon, they have become such a significant partner in our area, they exceed the amount of revenue that we get from the federal government. So that's a big step for us.
I would imagine affordable housing in Central Oregon is a major, major issue relative to other parts of the state.
Yes. As you know, we live in a very expensive area. It's beautiful. People flock there. And we have our challenges with NIMBYism. But the one thing that really stops the NIMBYs in their tracks is that when we demonstrate our portfolio and the success stories of the families who have moved to that housing, fostering dignity and raising a standard, our philosophy is you lay a standard here, people will go there. If you keep the standard here, that's where they'll be. And that's the problem that we have oftentimes with the HUD public housing green model. So having said that, we have a real interest in making sure that the Housing Trust Fund is actually funded to a level that provides us some assurance that when we walk in that door with these wonderful properties, it's a competitive process. So we sharpen our pencils, we go to work, we present projects that compete against other housing properties in our region, which I happen to like that competition because it elevates up the standards and it introduces some creativity, which I think is very helpful. So we want to see that housing trust fund increase to $5 million. Second, to reinforce what Bob said about the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, we'd like to see that move from 6 to 11 million. And this is one program that we are able to really leverage to get those rents down to folks at a much lower income level. Instead of taking a look at the classic projects where you warehoused people in big buildings and they all were unemployed with no hope, this is an opportunity to serve people at 30% of median up to 60% of median in a way that integrates folks into the community as opposed to isolating them in projects.
Well, say that again. What was the fund you wanted to increase from 60 to?
From 6 million to 11 million is the cap for Oregon Affordable Housing
Tax Credit.
Thank you.
We've used that on almost all of our developments.
That's the credit that brings the interest rate down about 4%.
Thank you.
I can't speak to everyone in all housing authorities in the state, but I will tell you this, that through the Housing Trust Fund, we have been able to take $1 of Housing Trust Fund and leverage as many as $15 to get our developments done. Now, that's a huge leverage ratio that without that housing trust fund, I'm not sure our developments would work, particularly in rural areas where the area median income is much lower than the metropolitan areas, and our gaps are much broader. It costs as much to develop a 50-unit housing project in Bend as it does in Portland. But Portland has much higher median incomes than we have in Bend. And so the challenge is, how do we leverage resources so that we can close that gap? And the Housing Trust Fund gives us that leveraged resource. And we were able to get in with that dollar on the front end so that it assists us in hiring architects and doing a lot of the due diligence up front that smaller agencies oftentimes don't have the capacity.
So help us here. Give us a little 101. On the Housing Trust Fund, are you able to make application?
Yes.
And you're able to pick up a grant for
right.
some fungible or flexible dollars you can use for architects,
right.
engineers, planning, et cetera.
And it's awarded with an entire development. So we propose a development, and those resources are awarded as a full package. So it's not like a capacity-building grant that's just given to us without a development that's going to be complete at the end of the cycle.
Got it.
When we provide that application, it is fully financially feasible. It's got design completely done. We're only going to be awarded the funding if it's a ready-to-go project. And Cindy mentioned the leveraging. I looked at three projects that the Salem Housing Authority has used with Trust Fund, and we've leveraged between $14 and $17 for every dollar of tax credit.
And part of your planning or trust fund. Is not just the construction, but it's also after the keys turned, how you're going to operate
oh, yeah.
and
Absolutely.
Maintain and cash flow
mm-hmm.
the property.
Right. Housing is a business.
You bet.
Real estate management is a business. And there certainly is an orchestration that happens between the needs of the residents, the needs of our investors, our partners in the state, and being good neighbors.
So if you didn't have a cash flow plan for how you're going to operate the facility after it's done, would you expect to get funding?
No. I would not want to operate it.
That is a component of the application also, is showing what our management plan is and who's going to do the management, what's their track record.
Thank you.
You're welcome. One last comment. The bully issue, it's a huge threat to us in affordable housing. And I appreciate the efforts of Bob Repine and his staff in trying to address this. This raises costs significantly, particularly in our area. I've got a lovely mixed-use development in downtown Bend that we worked very hard to get placed. It's 44 units of workforce housing above retail. And the economic impact of BOLI is over $1 million on that particular project. So we're very concerned whether or not we're going to get that.
The prevailing wage rate.
Right. Little Davis Bacon.
Got it. Thank you. Got it.
And Mr. Chair, if I may.
Cindy. Senator Russell.
I know you guys have just participated in, you know, a very creative senior low-income project on the west side of Bend, which is one of the fastest growing, most, you know, price driven. Used to be that's where the low income housing was, and those
right.
little, you know, starters that used to be 55, 65, 75,000 bucks are now 250. I mean, it's just incredible what's happened over there. My question is on that west side senior low income, because that contract has already been signed, assume we don't know what will happen exactly on the bully thing. Would that project be impacted, or is because that's already been inked, is that...
I don't think that project will be impacted. It's those projects that we haven't actually started construction yet.
Okay.
So it is
just one more thing, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
You can tell by Cindy's, you know, the cut of her dress and her articulate, passionate testimony that, unlike the guy sitting right behind her, you know, he is from Bend.
He's so flattering. I love that. Well, I thank you for all your support in affordable housing, Senator Westland. Without you and a strong voice, lots of Central Oregonians would be left unserved.
And let me tell you, we hear about Central Oregon all the time from Senator Westland.
Good. Good.
Good. It's all good.
Well, we have absolutely beautiful affordable housing developments, and just to just to take one more moment.
You bet.
We are entering into a partnership with Boys and Girls Club. We are buying a mid-70s apartment community in Bend. And we bought this community that was located across from another tax credit property that we have. And we are bringing the first site-based Boys and Girls Club program in Oregon right on site, and we're so excited about that. These kids will be dropped off at the, you know, at the curb, and they'll go right in to their homework clubs. We've got tennis courts, we've got rec halls, all of that that is going to make the partnership very fun, because
so
they can provide the services.
Have a place to send Senator Westland after.
Exactly. And he has volunteered to be the basketball coach. I don't think he knows that yet. But oh, it's out of his generous pockets.
It's out of what?
It's out of his generous pockets.
There you go.
That's right.
There you go. Well, thank you very much for the two of you coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate those good comments. Let's see. Okay. Do we need to? Okay, we're still in public hearing. Satish. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Perhaps you can give us a quick overview of the GAS's recommendation, or governor's recommendation.
Governor's recommendation.
That's right.
Well, Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, good afternoon. This is Satish Upadhyay with the Department of Administrative Services, and I will be providing you with an overview of the governor's recommended budget for the Housing and Community Services Department. And if you will please turn, refer to my presentation handout. Now, the charts on page 2, you've seen it a number of times. This the charts show you the recommended budget for the entire Economic and Community Development Program area, which consists of 5 state agencies, including the Housing and Community Services Department. The governor's recommended budget for this program area is $5,326.4 million total funds. This is about 13% of the total state budget. This program also has $136.9 million of general funds and lottery funds. This is a little over 1% of the general fund and lottery fund state budget. The Housing and Community Services Department's budget is 47% of the total program area's budget. It's $2,495.9 million of total funds. This includes $9.8 million of general fund and $4.5 million of lottery funds. Moving on to page 3, the agency's role as Oregon's low-income housing finance agency, as well as its programs to support and administer federal and state anti-poverty, homeless, energy assistance, and community services programs. They support the governor's principles regarding health and basic needs. Moving on to page 4, the chart there shows you the various fund types that make up this agency's budget. As you can see, 93% of the budget is non-limited. It's $2,388.9 million. This is all related to the agency's bond-related costs and programs, because it is the state's low-income housing finance agency. It's mostly related to that. And also the federal non-limited funds are the funds that the agency gets from the Human and Urban Development HUD, the federal agency, to provide rental assistance to low-income people, to make sure that they don't have to pay more than 30% of the income on housing. The agency has 47 programs, and if you look at the agency presentation documents from page 33 to 37, it lists all the programs and shows how each program is funded. The general fund is for the state homeless assistance program, emergency housing, and emergency food programs, and the lottery funds are to provide debt service payments. Like, it was in, I believe, in 2001 that the agency issued around $20 million in lottery back revenue bonds, and lottery funds are provided to pay the debt service on that. And this is for the community incentive fund that you heard about earlier. Moving on to page 5. This shows the various program units that make up this agency's budget. Until this biennium, this agency just had one program unit, based on input from the Legislative Fiscal Office and the Budget and Management Division of GAS. Now the agency has 5 program units. I think Mr. Krieger will be talking in detail about each of the program units after I do my presentation. Turning on to page 6, it shows the various expenditure categories. Again, debt service and special payments make up a major chunk of the agency's budget. These are all related to the finance activities and the special payments to various governmental as well as non-governmental entities. Personal services is 1% of the budget, and services and supplies is also 1% of the budget. You will notice that under services and supplies, there's around $24 million. That's quite a high number, and that's also related to expenses related to the issuance of bonds. It relates to like bond issuance costs and bond council costs. A major chunk is that. Moving on to page 7, the table on page 7 does a comparison between the 2005 legislatively adopted budget and 2005-2007 governor's recommended budget. When we do a comparison, the limited budget is down by 2%, and by the non-limited budget, there's a big increase of 97%. And the reason for this huge increase in the non-limited budget is because of the the agency issues is a large volume of one-year notes that create debt service and maturity and subsequent refunding. So it's all related to bond issuance and debt service costs.
That 97%, Satish, is almost enough.
It's almost enough? If you say that.
Yeah. Sniper.
The major policy issues that were considered while developing the governor's budget. The governor's budget continues all existing programs. The governor's recommended budget does incorporate a 10% general fund reduction. And there's a reduction to the statewide homeless assistance program of $832,027. This is a 30% reduction. And there's also a $250,000 general fund reduction to the home ownership assistance program. And you will notice that the budget continues 20 limited duration positions as permanent positions. 14 of these positions are related to the HUD contract administration program. The agency has been the contract administrator for HUD since 2001. The agency was first awarded this contract for a two-year period, then it was extended. Now the agency has been told that they will be getting this contract for another 10 years. So we are recommending that these positions be now made permanent. There are also two positions in the emergency assistance program, and Director Refine talked a little bit about that. And there are three positions in the property and management compliance program and one position in the home program. All of these positions are currently limited duration, and these were approved mostly by the 2003 legislature, and the agency is now requesting that these be made permanent based on the permanent nature of the workload. There are two new positions added to the budget, and this is to work in the loan programs and to administrate the weatherization grants. Passage of Senate Bill 1149 during the 2001 legislature provides the agency with the public utility funds, and these are used for weatherization purposes, and the agency needs these programs to administer these funds. Lastly, there's one reclassification of a position in the Asset and Property Management Division based on evaluation of current duties. Okay. And lastly, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, if you will turn to page 9.
Satish, I'm going to interrupt you
real
quick.
Would you explain to me what you said about the two new positions as far as how they're being paid?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, the two positions, one is a half-time position. It's an office specialist position, and the other one is a public representative two position. These positions will work in the loan programs and will administer the weatherization grants. Like the 2001 legislature passed Senate Bill 1149, the electric deregulation bill,
right.
And that bill provides housing with some responsibilities
so
and funding.
So they would be paid from the public purposes money?
It's a major portion of
3%?
That.
3%?
Yes.
Public purposes money?
It is the public purpose money, yes. Okay. Lastly, there are several technical adjustments. The first technical adjustment is moving the housing for opportunities for people with AIDS program from the Housing and Community Services Department to the Department of Human Services. This is a program where the two agencies have come to an agreement that it's a better match if it's moved over to the Department of Human Services, as it will get rid of redundancies. So what we are proposing, a technical adjustment to reduce the agency's budget by $1,453,165 of federal funds, and there will also be a reduction of four positions, which is 2.5 full-time equivalent positions. And next, we are also requesting a technical adjustment to correct an error in the governor's budget. This is to reduce federal funds by $84,558 from personal services. This is, the agency has a package 104 on all program units to realign costs and do also cost allocations. We put in a little bit more money, so we'd want to get rid of that. Lastly, under the this agency is one of the agencies that's taking part in the scenic project. And for all of the 12 agencies that are participating in the scenic project, we're supposed to do a $1 shift from personal services to services and supplies, and we forgot to do that during the governor's recommended budget. So we are proposing a technical adjustment.
Satish, let me ask you a question on the proposed organizational chart that's in this notebook they've given us. It's a silly question, but I want to ask it. There's no vertical or horizontal line between the director and the deputy director and the chief financial officer. They're set up as, they're shown as three separate categories. Is that just a printing there? These folks still report to you? Chief
financial? I think so.
They try to isolate Bob as much as possible, Mr. Chair.
There's not been
a successful strategy.
Mr. Chairman, Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Housing. Mr. Krager, our CFO officer, is in charge of setting up that chart, so maybe he's sending me a set message. I don't know.
Well, then there's a real signal here, because in 03 they show they didn't report to you.
We did.
So, okay. I'm just curious. Just asking. Okay.
Yeah, Bob, you better watch your back there, buddy.
Any questions of Satish? Satish, let me ask one more question, and if this is a question you need to get back to me with, I'm fine with that. I need to know the background on why Community Development Block Grant is administered in two different departments, and what the rationale was or is for not bringing it all together under Housing and Community Services.
Mr. Chair, I'd have to get back to you. I believe the other department is the Oregon Economic and Community Services Department.
Yes, yes. And I guess what I'm looking for, as Senator Johnson stated in a committee earlier today, a compelling reason, and I'm going to underline compelling, as to why we should not bring those two together under one house.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'll get back to you with that.
Yeah, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate that. I think we're going to go to phase two of the presentation in budget detail, and we're going to ask Rick to come on up. Let's see here. How do you want to do that? How much time? You're going to need quite a bit of time. Here's the thing: we've got to go into a public hearing on Senate Bill 636. Would you prefer just to start tomorrow? Fresh, is that?
That's fine. Yeah.
Why don't we do that? And so what I'm going to do is close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5515. I'm going to, and on House Bill 2052. I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 636 relating to landlord-tenant law. I'm going to thank the department. You're more than welcome to stay if you'd like. We're now going to invite up. How do you want to do this? You want to come on up? Okay.
And Mr. Chair and members, by way of introduction, Senate Bill 636 is probably one of the first substantive bills that's been before this committee. It establishes a registration program within Housing and Community Services for manufactured dwelling park and floating home mortgages, and requires continuing education as well as some other technical changes that don't apply to the housing department within this bill. So there's a staff measure summary in the packet that was delivered to your office today.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for giving us the time. My name is John Van Landingham. I'm a legal services lawyer in Eugene, work with Lane County Law and Advocacy Center. I represent low-income tenants. With me is Pat Schwach, who represents park residents. tenants who own their manufactured home and rent a space in a park. And John Benneman, who represents the owners of those parks, MHCO. We're here in support of Senate Bill 636A. I'll be very brief. Since the early 90s, changes to this law have only occurred through a coalition of landlords, tenants, and other interests, such as lenders and the people who make manufactured homes. On the front page of the handout that I've given you, I've listed 11 organizations represented by 19 different people who participated in our coalition, which met 16 times over the last year to negotiate 636. We've done this since 1997, each session. This is our recommendation to the legislature for improvements to landlord-tenant law regarding manufactured housing in parks. The bill, while lengthy, really only covers three major issues. Those issues are, and Senator Verger has already heard this twice, so I apologize to her. Those three issues are, first, requiring that park owners first register with Bob Repine's agency, and secondly, take mandatory training, 6 hours every 2 years. The residents view this as an important way to ensure that park managers know the law and make their living situations better. The second issue has to do with utilities in parks. And what it does is allow park landlords, for the first time, to unilaterally amend rental agreements, which is generally a no-no, to install submeters on spaces, primarily for water, but it could be for any utility there, build the tenant that way. The utility bills the landlord with a master meter. The landlord would have a submeter which would measure actual consumption at the space. This will encourage conservation. It will give the tenants control over their individual consumption. It's been a problem for tenants in the past when a single elderly tenant who's trying to conserve on a limited budget is paying the same amount as a family of five with three teenagers taking long showers. But the landlord, under a master meter system, has no way to know how much an individual tenant is consuming and has to charge everybody roughly the same. So this will allow landlords to do that. We had a lengthy discussion before in prior committees. I want to note that this particular issue was reviewed by the electric utilities, who wanted to make sure that we didn't mess with them. We have made amendments to make sure that we don't. Anytime a landlord does this sort of conversion, the landlord would have to comply with local utility policies and state policies. This has also been reviewed by the PUC staff. Apparently they had some time after they finished the PGE case. And they've signed off on it, and we've made some amendments to make them happy as well. The third and last issue has to do with recreational vehicles. A lot of Oregonians live in recreational vehicles, both as vacation homes but also as permanent homes, and we understand that some legislators do during the session as well. Some local governments have limited occupancies in RVs to 30 days in parks. This bill would say that local governments can't do that as long as the occupancy is, one, in a park, and two, that there are lawful hookups for electricity, wastewater, and water. And there are some protections built in as well for those RV tenants in their relationship with the park landlords. So that's a very quick summary. I'd be glad to answer questions.
Really quick. I'm sorry, Senator Berger, then Senator Morris.
Weren't these two different bills that I voted on? The RV was connected to the metering?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, that's correct. It's all one bill. There is a separate bill by the apartment coalition, which is a House bill, but we generally come to, separately, the two coalitions. But this is one bill, Senate Bill 636.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Who is in opposition to this bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, no one.
Thank you. That makes it easy.
Uh-huh. It was not easy getting here, I can assure you.
Or but getting to that. He doesn't like it out there. I can see it.
Share with me really quick on the individual meters. Do the utilities regulate those individual meters to make sure that consumers are protected for accuracy? You've got the main meter. You have the sub-meters. Who makes sure those submeters measure correctly?
Mr. Chair, I don't know that anyone monitors the sub-meter accuracy.
Okay.
The utility would measure, the utility is responsible for the master meter that runs into the park. The landlord would own the sub-meter. But what we've done is, with recommendations from the PUC, made sure that the policies of the utility have to be followed. So if the utility had a policy requiring sub-meter inspection, the landlord would have to comply with that.
Next question I have is on the education. Can you expand on the mandatory education?
Mr. Chair, what we've done here is modeled after the state of Nevada, which has been doing this for quite a while. And we had the administrator of the Nevada Manufactured Housing Division come in to Salem and meet with us. She indicates that mandatory education works well for both tenants and landlords. It's, she believes that it's resulted in a direct decrease in the number of complaints to the state by tenants, by park residents. What we're going to do here, it's a fairly simple, we've taken a fairly simple approach and said that that each park must have some person, preferably the person who's actually doing the day-to-day management, who would have to do this training 6 hours every 2 years. A majority of the training has to be on landlord-tenant law or related law, such as fair housing law. The people who do the training, which we expect to be the organizations that landlords belong to, such as Mr. Brenneman's organization, but we're not regulating that. The state would, HCS would monitor that and make sure that the classes are approved. The cost to HCS, and I would believe this is why this is before your committee, the cost to HCS to do the registration and the mandatory education to administer those programs is covered by a $6 fee that the residents already tax themselves. The residents imposed this. You adopted the law, but it was the residents' idea to fund the manufactured housing. Used to be called the Ombudsman Program, and frankly, I can't remember the new name. But there's money within that now to cover the cost of the agency to do administer those programs. Did I answer your question?
You did. This is just a public hearing. I scratch my head on this as a person who just liquidated and moved off of a park. The laws are very complex, anyway.
Mr. Chair, if I could, that's one of our theories, is that they are complex, and we would actually reduce landlord liability by making sure that the people who represent those owners know what they're doing, knowing the law.
Senator Berger.
Mr. Chair, I need to disclaim that I own a manufactured home and a park, and actually this bill would help me because I only am there during session times and when I attend meetings in Salem. However, I am opposed to the bill, voted no. I believe that the people in the park will eventually get all the cost of the metering, and I don't believe that their bills will go down. And we had a little exchange with the park management there at Lakeside Village, and I'm convinced after that conversation that it will not be. But that's just my position, and certainly they have a whole coalition of people that have a different position. But we have people in the parks who $20, $30 is a lot of money to them. And there is no better place in the world to live during session than to live in a very diversified population of people where you have contact and neighbors with all levels, economic levels. And so for that reason, I am just opposed to the metering, because I believe that the cost will eventually come to them.
Thank you. Representative Abaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the committee members who haven't had the benefit of having Pat Schwalk and her husband, Fred, who is at the back of the room there, terrific statewide advocates for homeowners and very popular, and even more so in Washington County, where I'm from. But I want to invite you to make any comments regarding Senator Berger's comments, and we're short on time, but just a minute, if you could, on what you see in this package that's going to benefit the homeowners.
Yes, Chair Smith and Representative Vock and Senator Berger. This has been a long, hard-fought bill for us, and I need to tell you right up front that way back when, my husband and I, we never learned, we've lived in three different parks, but way back when,
Pat, before you get going, why don't you just introduce yourself?
I'm sorry. Pat Schwack, Executive Director of Manufactured Homeowners of Oregon. And in the park we lived in previous to this, I spent most of my time opposing the landlord because he kept saying he was going to bring in water meters. Well, we decided we'd had enough of that park. We moved to Newburgh, and the park we're in now has meters. And I find that it's probably the best way to do things because, as John mentioned, if I'm a lady alone, my water can be so much, but if I happen to live in a family park and we find increasing numbers of children in these parks, I'm paying for their water just the same as anybody else's. I think it's the only fair way to operate. And we've talked it over with our membership by and large, and I find there's no problems over the decision to do it. I just feel that it's probably the best way to handle a bad situation. And with water as expensive as it is anymore, the landlords are looking for all kinds of ways to cut costs on the amount of water that's used. So that's my best comment. Thank you.
Mr. Brenneman, anything from you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Brenneman, for the record, I represent Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon and have since 1992. In the past, Pat and I have had our difficult times in prior sessions, and as many legislators have been around the Capitol for a long time can attest, there have been a lot of demonstrations and downright ugly fighting in the hallways and the committee rooms between our groups. It has been the last few sessions that things have gotten better and better, and that's the great thing about a coalition. Sometimes you give up something you don't want to give up. In this case, the landlords are giving up a mandatory training program, which we have fought like the devil in the past to keep from happening. But having said that, Manufactured Housing Communities represents about a little less than fewer than 500 parks around the state of all sizes. There are, I think, about 1,200 parks. There are a lot of parks out there that aren't within our membership that don't do a very good job of training their managers, and we think this will benefit us, too, in some regards. You see, Pat and I have determined, and John, too, that we get a little out of each of our issues. They get a little bit out of ours, and we get a little bit out of theirs, and we think we've crafted, although it's taken a long time, we think we've crafted a pretty good bill. We're committed to, along with them, to go back at the table after this session and see if we can get further on some of the issues that are problems in the industry for both of us. And we'd urge the committee at some time or some future committee that's going to get this bill to pass it on to the floor of the House and Senate.
Okay. Thank you. Senators, any questions? No?
We're not moving this bill.
No, we're not going to a work session today. Well, in the few minutes that we had with you today, I don't think it could possibly express the years that have gone into crafting something like this. But we'll commend you for the very hard work that you've put in and come to an agreement that you can all live by. And is there? These are the only three we had signed up to testify. Is there anybody else in the room that would like to testify on this particular bill? Mr. Repine, you or any of your staff are welcome to take the table to talk about how this program would be administered, if you'd like.
Good idea. While they're coming up...
Not required, just if you would like.
Sure. Good deal.
Yes, Senator.
While they're coming up, Mr. Chair, it's just good to see Pat and John. We've seen them at the same witness stand before, but it usually hasn't... Though, you know, the words haven't been quite as... generous. So it's good to see you guys at the same witness stand promoting the same bill. That's compliments and kudos to all of you guys. Yeah. Okay. Don't take this too far.
Mr. Director.
Chairman, thank you. Committee members, Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Housing Community Services. We do administer the what was the Manufactured Housing Ombudsman Program, now to be named a name from last session, which E will tell you, because I'm like John, I can't remember, it's too long. Either I'm getting too old, or the other. Just to kind of put some highlights on the meetings that you heard about, those meetings are actually conducted within our agency. They meet with us in our committee rooms to hash this issue out. This has been a long-standing organization that we've been involved in for many, many of those discussions over many, many years. And so actually I think the kudos go to all parties that come to that that table for discussion, because it can be very gnarly at some times, but you know, they also seem to realize that they've got to get off of their issues and move to a common area where they can agree on things. And so I think this is one of those fine pieces of legislation they bring to you. As far as the mechanics of how this will work, you did hear Pat or John Van Lanham mentioned that the resources that are paid via the $6 annual fee by residents and parks that we receive from counties is the resource that pays for the current manufactured housing program that we administer today. I don't know whether or not into any details I've been informed of how it will flush out. What I would do is, Mr. Chairman, if you would, I'm going to put Eve Ford on the spot, and she's been attending those meetings. She might be able to give you a snapshot of what that process might look like and how it would evolve. My suspicion will be, though, it would be a very open process to make sure that the training would be something that's both agreeable by the park residents who are funding this and the manufactured park owners who will be the recipients of this. So there's a common ground of understanding what will be presented and what value it will bring to those parties over time. I suspect there is probably at least a starting framework that we'll work from.
Good. Ms. Ford?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eve Ford, and I'm with Oregon Housing Community Services, and it's the Manufactured Dwelling Park Community Relations Office. And I, too, would like to add my commendations to the work of the coalition. This bill is well-crafted and is, as they've said, going to solve a number of disputes before they ever happen. Prevention is a good thing, and good information passed around statewide by qualified organizations is going to make this bill very effective. I did not work directly with the coalition this year. My former division administrator, Jeannie Arana, was the one who staffed that coalition, but I know a lot of work has gone into this. Just to tell you real quickly, in terms of our role, will be to receive the registrations of the trained individuals. We are not actually providing the training. What the key advantage, I think, in my mind to this is right now we compile a park directory, a listing of all the parks statewide. There are, at this moment that we know of, 1,448 parks. It's a voluntary registration. This would make it mandatory, so I think our information would be better. Right now, the mortgages and floating homes are not required to register. It is voluntary, so there will be some changes. So I think better information will be had, and as the coalition members said, there are some significant benefits in terms of perhaps resolving disputes before they ever start. My staff provide mediation services, conflict resolution facilitation. We feel that I would estimate, saved over $1 million a year in terms of disputes that don't go into courts. The court costs these days are very, very expensive. You can imagine that these cases, if they did go to court, would be very long and contentious and expensive. So if we can sit down in a voluntary process and let the disputants work out situations, everybody wins. So I'm pleased to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Committee, anything? Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you give us an idea of what kind of fees you're anticipating?
In terms of the revenue, as far as the...
For the size of the park, or if you've scaled it, or it's one size fits all?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's a $6 per home assessment. We get approximately $1 million a year in revenue each year.
Just to clarify, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
It's to administer our entire dispute resolution program, not just this program. I would estimate, in terms of, we did a preliminary estimate of the what the impact on this program would be. We would estimate that it would cost approximately $8,000 a year, $8,500 a year, $17,000 a biennium to run this program. It's a small registration program, a follow-up of ensuring continuing education for the landlords that would be trained through a different organization, a nonprofit that would be a trade industry organization, like Mr. Brenneman, who testified earlier.
Ms.
Brown, did you want to add to that?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to clarify. The $6 is already in place. And
right. Yes.
Yeah. So this is not, excuse me, Mr. Chair, this is not a fee on top of the $6. Yep. This is just incorporated within the $6.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, again, if you go back to the history of the assessment of the $6 now, it used to be $3 about 4 or 5 years ago. This was an assessment that was brought to the Legislative Assembly by the residents to in a sense, parlay their money together so they'd have a resource they could use for the purpose of dispute resolution. So, in effect, is their money. I think what they are doing here is making a revisit of the discussion of how that money is being used and saying, amongst the other things that we get for our money, we would like now this to be something also that we manage or this agency runs the registration on, because it would be good information that would be beneficial for all residents and park owners. And so it's, I think, them saying, if you, in the resources you have, we would like to see you also do this.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd just like to add to Mr. Repine's remark there that there is no fee for this service, and there's no fee for the dispute resolution or facilitation services that my staff offer. This is already covered by the existing fees.
Thank you. Anything else, Committee? Well, Director and Ms. Ford, thank you for getting up and shooting from the hip on this. It actually was quite helpful. And if there's no further testimony on Senate Bill 636, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 636. And unless there's anything else from the committee, I think, Mr. Krager, we will just start anew with you tomorrow and adjourn for today.